All right, well, welcome back to Firewall. Thanks for joining us. A really interesting episode today. We're here with Heather Cabot. She's the author of Geek Girl Rising, which is a book that I think is getting a lot of attention, so we're really excited that she was willing to join us. So before we get into the content of the book itself, how did you decide to write this? I mean, you do so many different things. You're a journalist, you're a professor, you're an investor, you're a blogger. So you didn't have enough free time? You're bored? Like, what happened?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
Sure.
You know, I think the really it comes down to the essence of who I am is I'm a storyteller. And I've been very fortunate in my life to have been able to tell stories in different types of media. So, you know, the early part of my career was in broadcasting and then ultimately in digital. And even with the investing, you know, the investments that I've made are all about companies that I think have a great story. Yeah. And as a sort of as a storyteller, what can I bring to them and to that team? That's sort of my lens on the few small investments that I've made as an angel.
So how did this story come to you then?
So it was sort of a convergence of a lot of different things. So number one, when I was first out of school, and I went to Columbia, to the J School, where I now teach, which is sort of a fun, you know, things coming full circle. I was a researcher on one of the first documentaries about women in computing called Minerva's Machine. It was a PBS film that came out in the mid-90s. And what's amazing about that is that this is pre-consumer internet, and it was sponsored by the Association for Computing Machinery. They sponsored this film, and I had the opportunity to work on it and sort of become kind of steeped in this issue around the gender gap in tech, which even at that time, so this is like 1993, 94, that was when we were starting to really notice a drop-off. And so that was kind of a formative experience, and then I went off to become an on-air TV reporter and anchor, which is what I wanted to do. But I had that experience in the back of my mind. So fast forward to 2007, I was hired by Yahoo to be their, you know, sort of consumer spokesperson, digital lifestyle expert, and my whole job was to cover how technology and how the internet was changing our day-to-day lives. And so I was aware that the gender gap still existed in the industry, and now here we are, and, you know, I mean, it's the dawn of the iPhone and the App Store and social media, and women are dominating on social media, and we're adopting to all this stuff. And but yet, you know, we were not making up the loss of, you know, of women who had stopped going into the field.
Yep.
So it was sort of this interesting, which I write about in the first chapter. But at the same time, for Yahoo, I was meeting a lot of women who were launching their own tech startups.
Right.
And I thought, that's a story that I don't think anyone's telling right now. And so it was really through that job, through Yahoo, that I had the luxury of kind of dipping my toe into that world and started to meet a lot of women who were in the early stages of launching their companies. And that were sort of the beginnings of it. So it's 2010, 2011 is when I first started kind of curating the interviews.
Got it. And then when you finally finished the book, did the conclusions that you ended up realizing and reaching match what you expected when you first started writing the book?
Well, a couple of things. I think when we, and I should also say, you know, I do have a co-author on this project, Samantha Walravens, who we ended up teaming up and, you know, late 2013, 2014 on this. I think when we initially dove into it, we were more focused on the problems that were holding women back and some, you know, the horror stories and the sexism and all the stuff that's really coming to light now. And well, what we found was that there were so many women that wanted to talk about how they had overcome that adversity. And so as mothers of daughters, we felt like, you know what, maybe the story here that really isn't being told is of triumph, of women who are kind of creating a new roadmap. I guess our conclusions were a little bit different, maybe more hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and we'll get to it, but kind of end the book in that direction. And it was an interesting, refreshing, but it was interesting contrast because there's so much coverage these days of all of the very real and pressing problems of sexism, sexual harassment in tech and in the Valley. So I think, you know, at least for me, it's sort of feeling this sort of onslaught of always reading all this coverage, say, okay, here's like all these great stories of women who have overcome all of these challenges to be successful. I think felt particularly timely in a You probably couldn't obviously predict it a couple years when you started writing this thing that like, wow, when this book comes out, we're going to be at like the height of all of these challenges. But it's sort of the timing is pretty perfect.
Yeah, we really, but you know, I think, well, there's a confluence of factors, I think, that led to that. Obviously, I think the resurgence of feminism just in general in our country right now is in an all-time high, given the results of the presidential election. Right. I think, you know, the women's march, women's marches all over, to me, felt like the energy that we wrote about in the book was like leaping off the page. It was the coolest thing to see that come to life and to validate a lot of the momentum that we were seeing. I personally believe that what we write about in the book, the movement we write about in the book, beginning in 2014 and even a few years before that, set the stage for what you're seeing now. I don't think that we could have seen women coming out in droves as they are now, holding investors accountable, telling their stories, and to see companies like Google actually go ahead and fire, terminate somebody.
Yeah, let's,
I mean, that could not have, I don't think that would have happened several years ago, but it's been building and building, certainly since the Powell case. Right. And we sort of show in the book, as you know, how in many ways social media has galvanized these women. I mean, the Fowler post could not, I mean, it went viral immediately. Why? Because women were all on the same page about this, and not just women, male allies, like men who were outraged by this. All, you know, people who believe that diversity and inclusion are the key to innovation, they're rallied together through social media in a lot of ways. So
Google acted really quickly to deal with it, and I would say admirably, although I think the engineer who was fired is already suing. Do you think that that's because the norms have changed and the view is like, of course we're not going to tolerate someone on our team who would write something like this? Or do you think just the pressure created by focus and social media and all that made it clear that from an optics standpoint, they had to fire him? I guess they did the right thing. And I guess I'm asking, because do you think what was the motivation?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's obviously it's optics, but I also think, and there was, I don't know, did you read the piece by the former senior Google engineer, and I'm going to get his name wrong, but it's like Yonatan Zunger. Did you read?
No.
Okay, he wrote this amazing piece on Medium. I think it came out maybe like on Sunday or Monday. And he basically was saying, you know, I don't work for Google anymore, so now I can say what I really think about this. And he basically said, if this guy worked for me, he would not be able to work on my team because, you know, he's created such a hostile environment that it would be completely counterproductive to getting anything done. And he's basically insulted the very people who work with him to say that they're not fit to have these jobs. So, I would guess that there's a lot of internal strife going on that perhaps the company was concerned would affect productivity and innovation and all those things. So I think it's both. And I think it's also, it's walking the walk, right? Like, you can't say that you care about this issue and you want to solve this problem and tolerate that kind of outright, hate speech. I mean, it really was intolerant what this guy said. But I also understand his point of view, too, which I will say. And I think it'll be, the Wall Street Journal had a great piece today about just speech in the workplace. Yep. And I do think that there is an interesting conversation about that as well. And companies are going to have to grapple with that because, you know, you do sort of want a free flow of ideas.
Right.
But then there's also, you know, how far do you go in terms of policing them? So who knows what will happen with this guy's lawsuit, too.
Right. Do you think then the norms have actually changed over the last couple of years? And is it the Powell and the Fowlers of the world that have produced that kind of normative change? Or do you think that it's more people are generally worried about sort of being attacked or looking bad, and so they're sort of saying the right things? And by the way, does the distinction matter?
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna. I would hope the distinction matters, right? You know, you want people to care because it's the right thing to do. But, I mean, at the end of the day, right, it's about money. It's about power. And I think, I get this question a lot when I speak at companies. And I think that I've heard a lot of people say this, and I think it's true, which is that it is not – the onus should not be on minority groups, on women – to change the status quo. The onus is on the people who have power.
Yeah.
That is really, I mean, at the end of the day, right, you can have all kinds of diversity programs. You can have all kinds of groups, but if the people at the top are not being proactive in thinking about inclusion and thinking about the workplace and the culture that they're cultivating within that company, nothing's going to change. I don't think.
Yeah. If you were at Uber right now, or if Uber hired you and said, hey, we clearly have workplace and cultural problems, and Susan Fowler did a great job in sort of detailing those and getting them out there, what do we do? How do we fix them? What's your advice?
Oh, wow. I think it's part of it is sort of what we saw happen with Google, which is walking the walk.
Yep.
You know, not just paying lip service to change, but actually taking meaningful action to show that you hear what people are saying, being responsive to that. And I think, you know, diversifying leadership at the top and on the board. I mean, I think that's an important thing that needs to happen. You need to have, and I'm not just gender. I mean, not just gender. I mean, I think we need to have a real effort to bring people with all kinds of experiences at the highest levels of these companies, because, you know, how are you going to be sensitive to someone else's experience unless you have someone at the top who's chiming in and saying, hey, I mean, like we all have, I think everyone can agree, we all come into this world with biases, right? But how do we check them when we meet people who are different from ourselves and we hear their experiences? So I think it's about also listening, really listening.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things that I like to do here is hire people who come out of politics, because in a way, in order, especially if you're in any sort of diverse city or state, in order to win the election, you have to build coalitions of people. And as a result, you just have so much exposure. I mean, I'm Jewish, but I've been to black church like 100 times in my life, just because that's an important part of politics, right? And you just end up, you know, just becoming comfortable with everyone and understanding that everyone's got different perspectives, and that brings a lot to the table. And tech, you know, because I've only been a VC now for 2 years, is so much less that way than I think I had thought going in. Because you have these people who are, I think I was equating innovation and brilliance with sort of a more progressive mindset, and that's not the case. And I think I've been really, I was naive about that. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of experience the same thing? Or, I mean, you're kind of laughing as I'm saying this, which means, makes you think that I've sort of seen the same.
Well, yeah, that was my observation. Yeah. I mean, it is sort of counterintuitive, right? You would think that in a culture that is all about innovation and, you know, inventing the future, creating the future, that there'd be this very progressive mindset, and yet it's very stuck in these sort of 1950s, you know, Mad Men kinds of mindsets. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, I think a big part of it, I mean, well, you know, these are huge questions about gender norms in our society and how we're socialized. And I mean, I think those are all really important points. And that's actually why in the book, you know, it's a survey piece, right? You know, we're not saying there's any one specific magic bullet to fix all this. And we also chose, you know, thoughtfully not to only focus on one particular battlefront. Like, we were really writing for a very mainstream audience who loves tech, consumers of tech, who may not be aware of the gender gap and may not be aware that so few women are building these products and in leadership roles, and who may not see themselves as vested in the digital revolution. And so, you know, we wanted to kind of explain it to them that there's all of these different things that need to happen, right? Yes, we need to have girls and boys learning to code. You know, yes, we need more women on boards. Yes, we need to solve the capital crunch for female founders. We need to do all these things at the same time. And that's kind of what we were trying to say by kind of laying it out that way in the book.
Right. One thing in the book that you talk about that I thought was really interesting is that female entrepreneurs and female founders tend to sort of behave a little more deliberately, a little more fact-based, probably a little less prone to making these giant grandiose claims. And on one hand, as a human being, that's admirable. On the other hand, as an investor, I know that when I walk into a meeting and I'm being pitched, I do get somewhat seduced by kind of the vision and the big ideas and all of that. By being more restrained and more responsible, are female founders in a way hurting their ability to raise money? And like, would you encourage them to try to change their mindset around that? Or would you encourage investors to think differently?
Well, I think as Sharon Vosmek of Astia says in the book, you know, women should not be, you know, it's the paradigm that needs to change, right? Women shouldn't need to change. But in the reality of that is, you know, if you're an entrepreneur trying to raise money today, you know, you don't have time to wait for the paradigm to change, right? So I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, I think you have to understand, you know, I think your listeners probably, you know, understand the fact that, you know, the reason why women are more typically tend to be more sort of deliberate and sort of scrappy with what they because it takes a lot longer to raise money. So, and they don't have the same network as their male counterparts, right? So they're forced to bootstrap longer. They don't necessarily have the resources to take big risks, and they know that they're going to be judged, you know, that in a different way than their male peers. So I think a lot of times they want to prove out they prove out the business model over longer time. So they want to have sort of more concrete metrics to propose, and because they know that it's going to be that much harder. The other side of that, and Susan Lyne talks about this, BBG Venture, she talks about this in the investors chapter, is you're exactly right, you know, that women do sometimes need to be coached to sell the dream and to think bigger and to think beyond just sort of, okay, well, you know, this is the revenue that I'm projecting for this year, to have more, I don't want to say bravado, but, you know, maybe it's confidence to explain their vision in a way that's much bigger than what's on paper today. Right. And I think sometimes men are socialized to sort of take those risks and go out on a limb. Yep. I mean, I feel that way with my husband all the time. And it's hilarious. Like, we have these conversations about, you know, and he's a former journalist too. And, you know, I think it's socialization. In the investors chapter, and I'm gonna, and actually in chapter 4 too, we talked to Kay Koplovitz. She talks mm-hmm. about, you know, at Springboard, the accelerator for women-led businesses, you know, how there's a certain amount of coaching that goes on there, you know, not just sort of how to speak financial, but also how to sell the dream. So I think there's truth to what you say, but I do think there's that important underlying piece, which is that it is just harder for women to raise money. So yeah. They have to. It is going to take them longer, so they have to be more deliberate in what they do, and sometimes that bleeds into their presentation.
I wonder if some of this geographic, because I just think about some of our investments and portfolio companies and being pitched by like Audrey Gelman, who runs The Wing, or Susanna V, who runs Flip, and they certainly did not lack for vision, right? And clearly, they made the sale, right? Mm-hmm. But that they're in New York, and I wonder in some ways if just people here are a little more aggressive than on the coast.
Well, I think first of all, and I think we touch on this too. I mean, New York, because it attracts people from a variety of industries. You don't have to have sort of the engineer credibility that you have to have to make it in Silicon Valley, right? You're not dismissed out of hand because you didn't go to Stanford. Like in New York, I mean, you have people coming out of banking, out of fashion, out of media, you know, who go on to start these companies, and they're respected for that expertise, and they're confident in themselves because many of them have been very successful, you know, in those fields. So I think it's culturally, it's people are more accepting here of people who are not necessarily, you know, who don't have a technical background to start off. Whereas I think in the Valley, you're often dismissed right away.
Right. So one of the things I noticed in the book is a lot of the anecdotes and stories are women who have created successful startups around fashion, beauty, childcare. And I just was thinking about you as I was reading it, thinking on one hand, these are really good stories of really successful people. On the other hand, were you worried that in some ways they tend to reinforce gender stereotypes like, oh, these are women types of startups, as opposed to like the, you know, just hardware and B2B enterprise software and things like that? How'd you kind of resolve that in your head as you were going about this?
That was really by design, because again, we are writing for what I like to call the Good Morning America audience. I am not writing, you know, this is not a book for women in tech. I hope women in tech read it.
Right.
This is for people who, as I said before, love technology, love social media, but maybe, you know, don't think of themselves as, quote, techies. So we wanted to curate stories of women that were very relatable, and also women who were building businesses that a reader would be like, oh, I know that business. Oh, I know what that does. That's not to say that there isn't a book to be done about women in enterprise software or women in robotics. But I will say, and you know that the book has been optioned to become a TV series, you know, we're writing, there's a certain entertainment value to it. And it, obviously we want to inspire people and educate people, but you also gotta have to get them to read it. You have to get them to, like, you know, right, you know, and so, I mean, why do we have Michelle Phan in the book? You know, I mean, she's sort of, again, kind of a counterintuitive choice. But when you read her story, you realize why we included her.
Well, and especially because there was something in there I thought was just super insightful, which is you talk about how boys tend to gravitate more to Legos than girls. And I see this. I have an 11-year-old daughter, an 8-year-old son. She likes Legos. There's no question about it, but he's obsessed, right? Mm-hmm. It's all Legos all the time with him. But, you know, you mentioned that, and Michelle Phan was a good example that you did it, of how girls tend to be far outpacing boys when it comes to using social media to express themselves. And in the same way that boys maybe were getting this structural advantage around CS and engineering, maybe because some of the skills that Lego built, in terms of this whole new world of how we express ourselves through social media and all the businesses that can come out of it, do you think that girls are now all of a sudden getting kind of a different structural advantage because of that?
I mean, I think girls are so confident now with digital media. And boys, too. I mean, I have twins. I have a boy and a girl. And I you know, I see my son into movie making. And, you know, he loves being able to just, you know, go outside with the phone and, you know, make a cool video and edit it and send it out. And I think it's a generational thing. I think these kids are empowered now in a way that, you know, I never could have imagined. I mean, who knows what's going to happen to Hollywood, right? All you need is an iPhone, right? You don't really need anything else anymore. And you can be a star. And that's kind of what, and you can be, you know, a gazillionaire. I mean, you know, Michelle Phan, you know, I mean, who is she, right? But she's somebody who reached an audience that she figured out an audience that was hungry for the content that she had. Yeah. And, you know, and she's an amazing success for that and created a whole new business model. So one thing that I do think is interesting, though, right, is that our kids are, through some of these tools, right, they're becoming creators, not just consumers, right? So, you know, it's one thing to have them into gaming and things like that. It's a whole other thing, like Minecraft, where they're actually building things. Yeah. And I think that is different with this generation. And I think for boys and girls, it's setting the stage for all kinds of new innovation. One other point I just wanted to make on that was that in Chapter 7, we talk about a company called VidCode, which is an amazing software platform that's now being used in more than 10,000 school districts around the country. But what it is it teaches kids programming languages through making movies, through creating Instagram filters, through all kinds of cool stuff. So it kind of meets them where they're at and entices them with the creative stuff they're already doing, but sort of lifts up the hood and says, hey, this is what makes this work. I think it's brilliant, and I think we're going to see more of that.
So. Yeah, no, it's interesting. There's so much ed tech that you would just think logically could make school much more relatable, interesting, fun. And then I look at the other world of it and say, all of these companies, and we're always hesitant to invest in them and work with them because their business is also built on procuring contracts from 15,000 school districts all over America, which is the most miserable, bureaucratic, slow, and often corrupt process. And I worry that you have this great disparity of these like terrific ideas and technologies and platforms and this horrible distribution system to get it into schools. And as a result, you know, it's just, if you ever want to talk about stifling innovation, like look at the government RFP process.
Yeah. But I will say, I do, you know, having been very involved in public schools where I live, and having actually been an education reporter, I do think that if there is a mandate from the community, that's where you're going to see the change. Like, you know, whenever I speak and people ask, you know, what do you think about, you know, more computer science education and how can we get it? And, you know, I believe it's got to come from the local level. It's got to be from people in, you know, citizens saying to their school board representatives, this is something that we care about. This is something that we want funded. And this is something that we think is worth investing in. I think one of the biggest issues, and we do address this in the book, is the shortage of teachers. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that I know New York City is working on. It is a problem, but I don't think it's insurmountable. I think it requires a mind shift.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's a nice segue into what I want to ask you next, which is politics. So you've got this sort of weird dynamic potentially with Trump, where on one hand, and to be clear to the audience, I don't know Heather's politics at all. So for all I know, she's a huge Trump supporter. But I will say that you've got, she's shaking her head now. On one hand, you clearly have all these Trump proposals to limit immigration, right? Even highly skilled engineers, which seems to me insane. It's like telling like a baseball team you can't sign free agents. Like, why would you do that? On the other hand, logically, if it were to follow, okay, you're going to cut off foreign sources of engineering. You should be pouring billions of dollars into programs like Girls Who Code so that we can train people in this country to be engineers. But of course, that then requires A, a lot more money to public education, and B, these are programs focused heavily on girls and minorities and people who aren't necessarily, you know, core Republican voters. And Reshma was actually our first guest ever on our podcast. And so we're really into what she does. I don't have a question here. What are your thoughts around the fact that, like, theoretically, the kind of jingoism that we're seeing in Washington maybe actually creates a logical jumping off point for the kind of funding and programs that you talk about needing in the book? And you have some good examples of programs that currently exist and work, but obviously you're kind of calling for a lot more of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so there's a couple things. I think, obviously, you know, we need to get computer science education part of the public school system. We absolutely need to do that. And we need to find different ways to fund that. And, you know, you mentioned Girls Who Code. I mean, Girls Who Code is really, at this point, kind of filling the gap, because if you live where I live, and I live in a great school district, you know, my kids go to after school programs and camps to get coding. It's not part of what they do in their school. So that's number one. But I do think it's interesting that you asked this question, because we do address this in the chapter about colleges. I think a lot of the big tech companies, and I was actually having a conversation with someone about this today, but, you know, historically the shortage comes from the fact that they're also only recruiting from the top schools. They're only recruiting from MIT and Stanford. And my friend I was just talking with today, who works in the biotech industry, but she was talking about how Amazon and I think Google now have offices in Boston. And she said, you know, they're there because they want to recruit the MIT grads, like, and the Harvard grads, like, you know, right there. And, you know, but Pittsburgh is another example where, you know, Carnegie companies Mellon. Have moved to Carnegie Mellon, right? But the reality is that, and we quote a woman named Judy Spitz in the book, who you may know through Cornell Horizon. Tech.
Yeah.
And she says, listen, we're never going to fill all these jobs if we're only recruiting from these top, top, top schools. And I think what Verizon, what Cornell Tech, what she's doing with her group Whitney here in New York with City University of New York is a fantastic model where they are introducing computer science to students that may have never taken it before, who are many times the first in their family to attend college, and introducing this career path to them. I think that's huge. I think these companies need to be, and, you know, we've heard this actually from people of color as well, that, you know, these tech companies are not recruiting from historically black colleges and universities. They're not, you know, that they're graduating students that are not getting recruited. So I think there is a lot of opportunity here.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, you know, I don't want to get too political, but, you know, I wish we could have, you know, people coming in and opportunities for people here at the same time. And I think there is a way to do that.
Yeah.
That's also, you have to, it's, again, it's a shifting of how they do things, how they recruit.
And look, you're totally right at recruiting. We actually recently instituted a policy where we will not hire millennials out of Ivy League schools.
Mm.
Because quite frankly, they're too much of a pain in the ass. you know, sure, they're smart, but the reality is, like, what do? We do venture capital, we do politics. Like, it's not rocket science, right? We're not curing cancer here. And, like, it's not worth it that people that, like, have been so trained that they're special that you have to pat them on the head all day long. I'd rather have people that are hungrier, that went to a state school, went to a historically black college, whatever it is, and, you know, just don't need as much constant reinforcement. So just forgetting about, like, the fact that just these employers are choking themselves off to employees that they need, I think you're also recruiting employees that in some ways are just really more difficult to manage.
Yeah, and maybe have come, I mean, not all of them, but, you know, I don't want to generalize, but, you know, maybe have already, you know, sort of had a privileged upbringing, and, you know, they're sort of bringing that culture in with you, whereas if you're recruiting people who maybe are at a state school and maybe the first in their family to go to college, they come with totally different experiences. And again, that adds to the innovation and the conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought what you wrote about Eventbrite was really interesting, and would love two things. One is tell the listeners kind of what their policies are around kind of work-life balance, vacation, time off, things like that. And then give me your, I mean, clearly you like this because you wouldn't have written about it admiringly otherwise. And logically, it makes sense. So why wouldn't every employer adopt that approach?
So Eventbrite, so the chapter that you're talking about is the sort of leads off our work-life warriors chapter. And we start off with Julia Hartz, who's the co-founder and CEO of Eventbrite, and talking about the fact that she was pregnant with her first child when they were in, you know, full-on ramen mode. You know, they were in, you know, the very, very early stages of launching the company, she and her husband. And you know, her story is that having gone through that wrenching experience, and how, you know, really personally experiencing how hard it is to be a parent and to also be a parent to a startup, that they really committed to building into the culture of Eventbrite that they would really value their employees as people, not just for their productivity. And so, for example, one of the things we write about is that they have a take all the time that you need policy, which basically means, you know, you don't have a set number of vacation days or a set number of sick days, but, you know, it's up to you and your manager, you know, if you do need some time off, to be able to negotiate that. And we write about, you know, these amazing nursing rooms that they have and hospital grade equipment that's available. And, you know, I think to your question, look, you know, I think that millennials are clamoring for this, right? They don't want to work 24/7. They're now having kids, and some of these founders of these companies are now having their own kids. Yep. And they're realizing that it is very difficult to maintain that pace and have the life that you want, and also to be creative and productive. And, you know, when your life is out of balance, you just don't perform as well. And so I think that, but again, you have to have people who are at the top that see that and understand that and build that in from the beginning. And I think what happens a lot of times in these companies when they're starting out, and we interviewed a woman named Sarah Hollebeck, who is runs a consulting company called Luminary Labs, and she's the woman who wrote this human company playbook, where she, you know, lays out case studies of companies that she believes are treating their employees as human. And, you know, she talks about the fact that, you know, these and you see this, but these startups, it's kind of like the Wild West, right? You know, you got this idea, you're raising money, you got your head down, you're not thinking about HR. Like you're just trying to do what you have to do, and you're not thinking about that in the beginning. And her point is that the company should be thinking about that, and that if they do, they will be more successful, and they're going to retain employees longer, and they're going to have loyalty longer. Yep. So I think it makes sense.
I hear you. I mean, when the Holder report came out in the wake of some of the Uber stuff, I sent it to the CEOs of all of our portfolio companies, and I said, I know all of you will say to me, I wish I had Uber's problems and their valuation, but, you know, if you're successful, okay, $6 to $8 billion might not be a number anyone else hits, but nonetheless, the things that happen at Uber are the logical conclusion if you grow like crazy and don't focus that much on things like HR. Mm-hmm. So it's to your advantage to sort of pay attention to this stuff now and avoid these problems before, you know, before they become problems. Yeah. And, you know, I felt some took me seriously, some didn't reply at all, some just kind of got, you know, thanks. But I think that at the very least, all of the kind of bad press that Uber got and Travis got, although painful for them and as an investor, painful for me, I think definitely helped change some of those perceptions that will ultimately, I think, do what you're talking about, which is getting people to take this stuff seriously earlier on. I mean, that's, look, on everything on the political front that we do with our portfolio companies, it's the same thing. You know, they're in regulated industries most of the time. They don't think about the regulations, mm-hmm. Which is fine until either they find themselves on the receiving end of a tremendous amount of pain, and then sometimes they don't get off the mat from it. And our view is, like, let's figure that out in advance and avoid that. Same thing here.
Well, I was also going to say, too, I mean, when I talked to, I went to this great, 2 years ago, and actually it's not a scene in the book, but it could have been. We went to the Female Founders Conference at Grand Central Tech, mm-hmm. and one of the, which is this was a gathering of female founders from around New York City, and it was this great kind of like inside baseball, very candid conversation about what it's really like to raise money, what it's really like to run a company. I think one of the most dynamic panels they had was on hiring. Hiring is such, I mean, it can be a really thorny issue. Yeah. So I think, you know, to your point, like if you are mindful of that from the beginning, you really save yourself a lot of, I mean, forget about, you know, bad culture, but just in general, like, yeah. you know, if you take it seriously in the beginning, recruiting, finding the right fit, finding people that you know, and creating a culture where people are going to thrive, you'd be much more successful because people spend a lot of time trying to
yeah.
hire people and then get rid of them if they don't work. I mean, right. how do you, you know, so.
Yeah. No, look, I would argue a good culture helps you recruit and retain people. And I think about our own policies. Our margins are probably a little lower because of the amount of money we spend on benefits and kind of our policies around leave and things like that. But, you know, I think ultimately we're just getting much, much higher quality people coming here and staying here. And I think long run we make more money. And it's also just, it's a better place to work.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's the long view, right? It's kind of taking the long view, which sometimes is hard to do when you're in those early days and you're just running and gunning and you're just trying to, you know. But yeah. I think if you can step back and see the long-term investment and see that it will bear fruit eventually, I mean, I think it's worth it as, you know, as an observer.
Yeah. So you kind of get into a little bit in the book, this kind of two competing points of view on work-life balance, right? Lean in, lean out, or I don't know, that's probably lots of different ways to describe it. And, you know, the Reddit thought about it, and I was like, I'm not really sure. I guess there is no right answer, but what are the two kind of competing mindsets around this, and how do you assess them?
What you mean in the industry?
Yeah, well, kind of Sheryl mm-hmm. Sandberg on one side, was it Anna Marie Slaughter on the other, and they're just totally yeah. different points of view around.
Well, this. I think Sheryl has actually, I think that she's modified some kind of her original.
Sort of
yeah, I think she's
bit.
She
yeah.
has, you know, certainly in the last couple of years, I think she has, you know, addressed the issue that it look. To do everything all the time, I think what nobody ever talks about, and she got a lot of criticism for this, is that you have to have a tremendous amount of resources. You have to be able to have help. You cannot be, you know, the leader of everything in your home and in your profession and not have someone behind the scenes happening helping you if you don't have a spouse that's doing that.
Right.
It's just, I mean, That's just the reality of it, and I think that she did get some pushback on that. I do think that what I think is exciting in this whole sort of like gig economy and freelancing being much more fashionable and acceptable, and people not staying in jobs as long as they used to. I think it's really freed people, liberated people, to create different kinds of moments in their careers and not be judged necessarily because, you know, they dipped in and they dipped out, or they, you know, did, you know, wore a hat for this many years doing this and then they went and did something else. I think there's a lot more openness to that now. Yeah. And I think this conversation has been really healthy. I think, in fact, I was just, I had lunch with this woman named Gloria Felt, who was former national president of Planned Parenthood, who now runs an organization called Take the Lead Women, which is it's a consulting firm to cultivate female leaders. And she was saying the other day that if everyone put the fact that they're a parent on their resume, that, you know, it would totally normalize it, right? Like if men put that yeah. they were volunteering at the PTA and women did, you know, that it would just be part of who we are, and it wouldn't. And I think that's true. You know, we're so stuck in these gendered ideas of who we're supposed to be and why we're supposed to be that way and who's supposed to yeah. be at home, who's supposed to be at work. And it really, I have a lot of faith in this new generation, and especially with technology, which I think liberates us in so many ways from those, like, you have to be in the office 9 to 5. Yeah. I mean, I'm very optimistic that my kids will see work and family in a very in a different way.
And hopefully, I mean, one thing I noticed, and it's probably particularly acute, you know, living in Manhattan and, you know, having lots of friends in their 40s who both parts of the couple work and have big careers, is so when when the two members of the couple, whether it's same sex or actually in this case it would be the opposite sex by definition, when the husband, when the male does 50% of the child care and all the other stuff, the view is, I know it feels like, hey, look at me, pretty good, 50%, right? And then I think when the woman does 50%, even though it's 50%, there's definitely some guilt around that. Like, right. It's not enough, right? And yeah. How do you, I mean, I see this with my own wife, right? Like, so, and it's not, I would not want to do less 50% because I want time with my kids, right? So how do you start to sort of change that perception? Because clearly I just see that weighing on a lot of women that I know.
Yeah. I think it starts at home. You know, I think we all have a responsibility, those of us who are parents, to model the kind of households that, you know, we aspire to have. Not every day is perfect, you know, but I think it's important for, you know, I'll tell you a really funny story. So my husband, you know, is an entertainment executive. He travels a lot. He's, you know, and we live in Rye. We live in the burbs. And a few years ago, I had to take my daughter to some, and I've always worked. I've always had my pro. I haven't always worked full time, but I've done different things. You know, I mean, the book has definitely been like my first like real like foray back into full time work in the last few years. And so I had to take my daughter to something, and I didn't make dinner. Like, I didn't leave dinner for my husband and my son. And the next day, my son was probably like 6 or something. And he was like, Mom, you didn't make dinner last night and Dad had to order Thai food. And I was like, well, okay. He's a grown man. Yeah. Like, he can order. I mean, and it just, I was
Tuesday
like,
oh
my,
yeah.
I know. But I was like, oh my God, like, what is the message that I'm giving my child here? I have got to shake things up a little bit. And we talked about it with them. And, you know, so I think there is something to raising feminist sons. I do think that they're, you know, just as we want our daughters to be strong, we want, you know, our sons to recognize that, you know, in a household, we're a team. Like, everybody pitches in, and I think that's a really important thing.
And more valuable, right? I mean, that's just sort of the discussion my wife and I have had at times. Wherever she does feel guilty, I'm like, I think the message you're sending them by having this really active, successful career is ultimately a lot more important than if you were at pickup, right? Or if we're both at dinner. Like, because, well, it's not, and we're lucky that we both have enough, she's an academic, so we both have enough flexibility that we're both at more than enough stuff. But I think having, you know, I just think for my kids, forgetting about money one way or the other, but having a mom who has a really busy, successful career that she really enjoys, right? I think has a greater long-term benefit than whatever you would get by sort of the time freed up by not having that career.
I mean, I think what I'll say to that is that I think for every family and every person, it's a very individual decision. And having, and I think for myself, definitely having a career, having professional success makes me incredibly happy. And it makes my kids proud. And I love the fact that they're not the center of attention all the time. I think it's really good for them to know that I'm more than just Ian and Samantha's mom. Like, I think that's good for them sometimes. It makes them more independent and more resilient. That said, you know, I have a lot of friends who are full-time stay-at-home moms, and they're the people that, you know, things aren't going to get done at school, right, unless those volunteers do it. So there is, and just, you know, if I remember correctly from the Anne-Marie Slaughter book, too, you know, she ended up leaving her very prestigious job because she had stuff going on at home that she needed to deal with. So I tend to sort of really feel that's a very individual choice. And I think that there are times that you're going to be able to have that moment to just go gangbusters on your career and have both spouses, you know, able to do that. But there may be times that you need to dial it back, and that's okay. And I think that's kind of the bigger message. Like, that's okay. And my goodness, if you have the luxury to be able to do that, because hello, it is a luxury to do that. And I'm grateful every day that I've had the opportunity to do it, you know, in some of the years in that my kids have been at, you know, at the age that they are. I mean, it's a gift to even have the choice. I think that's kind of the bigger thing. Yeah. Sometimes it gets lost in this debate about work, stay at home, all this stuff, because most people don't have that choice.
Right.
And never will.
Yeah, absolutely. black women in tech. I mean, if we think that there's a dearth of women in tech, I mean, it's even vastly greater. And you talk about this a little bit in the book. So how do you solve that problem? Because to everything you've said so far in this podcast has basically been the diversity of experiences that people bring ultimately make a company a lot stronger because it can do a lot more to meet its customers' needs, right? And clearly, if there's one unmet area, it's African-American women. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, there are role models. Visibility of role models, I think, is huge. I think we really tried to, in the book, profile women that we thought were doing interesting things, like Catherine Finney, who I think is really a leader on this. She's the founder of Digital Undivided. She's the one whose organization came out with the kind of damning report about how hard it is for African-American women to raise capital. And she has now done something interesting that I think may be a model for other places, which is she's basically created an accelerator in Atlanta for Black and Latina founders. And not only is it an accelerator to help them raise capital and to ideate and kind of, you know, ultimately crystallize their business ideas, but what she's doing, which I think is amazing, is she's partnering with the historically Black colleges and universities mm-hmm. in that area, and she's pulling in software engineering students from those schools, giving them internships in the accelerator, because right, these kids are not going to get internships at Google or Facebook unless they know someone or unless they have the actual experience. How do they get the experience? So that was one of the things that she, you know, I personally think it goes back to the network. Yep. And I've heard that over and over, and it's creating that network for them. I mean, Catherine says in chapter 4, she said, you know, it's not a question of confidence for Black women. It's never been a question of confidence. It's a question of sponsors. It's a right. question of somebody giving me a chance, and she's really been on the front lines of fighting for this. I think that what we talked about earlier, some of these initiatives in terms of engineering for these companies to be looking at different kinds of schools, not only looking at the very, very top tier. And by the way, it is so hard to get into those schools anyway. There's so many great students that don't get in there.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that's really important. Recruiting, you know, going where people are. And then obviously, you know, organizations like Black Girls Code and other types of little, there's so many grassroots organizations that are popping up every day. I just heard about one that's, and I know I'm going to get the name wrong, but I met her at the, I moderated a panel about women in tech at this a festival at the Apollo Theater. And this woman runs a program in Bed-Stuy for kids to teach them. I want to say she is in gaming. She's a computer scientist herself, but she grew up in Brooklyn. And anyway, she actually struck up a relationship with Uber. And what they do is Uber provides free transportation for engineers working at some of the biggest companies in Manhattan to come out to work with these kids and to teach them and to introduce them.
Some positive press.
Yeah,
for Uber
I'll get the. Yeah, I know, right? I don't know if the program's still running this summer, but last summer it was. And I'll get you the name of it. But anyway, what I loved about this idea is that it goes to the heart of what I was saying earlier about role modeling, right? Like, how do you know what you want to be, what you want to grow up, if you've never met anybody who has that job? Like, right?
Right.
So I thought it was so brilliant that not only are they teaching these kids how to code, but they're also bringing in people outside their neighborhood to talk to them about what it's really like to have these careers, how, you know, how lucrative they are, how flexible they can be, how, you know, yeah. how creative and collaborative and all that stuff. That's so important. So I am optimistic that, you know, these types of grassroots activities and, you know, things that are like really happening at the local level, you know, that's, we need more of that.
Yeah. One of the best projects we've gotten to work on in a while is we built an incubator for at City College, which actually is part of that City CUNY network that you talk mm-hmm. about in the book, for minority women startups. I guess technically, because City College is a public school, it's open to everyone, but mm-hmm. they were able to do the selection criteria in a way that effectively made it 99 to 100% Latina and African-American women. But what was, I think, the most valuable thing was Standard Chartered Bank were the people who they were our client, and they paid for the incubator. But I think the thing that they do that has had the greatest impact both on the participants in the program and on the bank is really dedicating people from the bank to come speak, mentor, be part of the incubator. Mm-hmm. And I think that has had, what's interesting is both a much bigger impact than probably the, you know, the couple hundred thousand dollars a year or whatever they donate to run the incubator itself. The incubators aren't that hard to or expensive to really run. And it apparently it's like the most popular program in the U.S., in the New York office and all of the U.S. stuff, because people really enjoy kind of getting out of the world of finance into the real world and be able to sort of talk to people what they do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's sort of one of these things where it's a cliche to say it's a win-win, but it really was for the participants, or still is, for the bank and for City College.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that that's huge. That's a huge part of this. And that is network building too, right? It's not just introducing young people to role models, but it's also by when you make that introduction, an introduction they probably never would have had otherwise.
Yeah, never.
That's helping them build their Rolodex of people that hopefully they'll be able to turn to. And
right, because by definition, like, think of when come, I'm sure this happens to you all the time, people come here all the time for sort of career advice. They don't really just want advice. They want then, can you then connect them to the, and most of, unless they're like a real jerk, you do, right? And so it's smart, right? Because it's you're not just getting advice. You're tapping into someone else's network and you're getting the validation of that person. It's a smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's easier when, you know people who know you or me, and as a favor to them, we're saying, sure, we'll happily sit down with whoever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It works if you're already kind of in.
Yeah. Well, and that's what we write about with these women building these new networks, is that was really what we saw was this sort of like secret society of women all over the country who are willing to make those introductions and who are of the mindset that, if I shine, if you shine, I shine, right? You know, that it's this sort of anti kind of mean girl competitive narrative that we usually hear of, right? It's the complete opposite, which is that, you know, we want to rise together, and as opposed to competing with you, I want to see your success, and your success will you know, ultimately lead to my success,
right?
Because we're helping each other. And I think that is such a cool mandate that we saw. So, I mean, everywhere we went, you know, whether it was at the Grace Hopper Conference or in Chattanooga or Carnegie Mellon, I mean, all these different places, we saw that. And not just among young women, but older women too, you know, who, like the women at Golden Seeds, you know, who've had these amazing careers in banking, for example, and had the means to finally do something about this issue and support women-led companies. I'm really heartened by all of it.
Well, yeah, and when you look at happiness studies, one of the things they all conclude is that people who have some sense of volunteering and giving are happier because it creates a fulfillment and meaning, creates a certain feeling that you can't replicate by buying stuff or achieving stuff. And if you can, this is like a way for people to do it that really fits into their lives. Not everyone wants to go find a soup kitchen to volunteer every week. But if you can do it in a way that's taking advantage of what you already do at work and your expertise and your network, that you can generate a lot of that, you know, good feeling that kind of contributes to happiness. And it's pretty convenient too. So it's almost like a great lazy way to volunteer.
In some ways. I mean, yeah. I think depends on the, you know, on like on the context. Like I would say like the female investors would say, you know, this is, you know, we want to make money. We're investing in women because we believe, you know, in the value proposition of their businesses. But I see what you're saying. And I was also going to say one other theme that really emerged was that in terms of creating these networks, you're right, volunteering together. So whether it's going to a Black Girls Code hackathon or it's inviting high school girls to spend the weekend at Stanford with the computer science students there, or teaching sixth graders Python at Carnegie Mellon. One of the things that we observed, particularly among these young women, is that volunteering together to inspire the next generation was an incredible way for them to bond with each other in a way that like maybe men might do on a whatever, you know, a golf outing or a camping trip or something. They're bonding through this volunteer work and creating really authentic friendships with each other through that. I think that's really cool.
So you started writing the book, or at least prepped in like 2010, 2011, right?
So curating the interviews, curating the interviews.
So things have obviously changed in the past 5, 6, 7 years. Take where we are today, right, which is both all the success stories that you detail in the book and all of the issues and scandals as recently as the Google memo yesterday, right? Now, fast forward 5 years from now, where do you think we'll be?
I think that given the national attention to this issue, I hope that we will be further along. I do think that there are some really deeply entrenched institutional problems that may not be fixed in 5 years, I think, is a little too soon. Like, yeah. I don't think we're going to change the makeup of venture capital firms
right.
in 5 years. But I do think that, the Facebook just came out with their stats last week. I think 27% of their engineering workforce is now female, which was a big uptick. So I do think that we will see progress, but I think we also have to recognize that some of these things go back to society and societal issues that we have to grapple with, all of us, you know, not just in tech, but just in general, and how we, men and women, people relate to each other. And our country is so polarized right now that I worry that it's not going to happen now. I hope that we can all be unified around something. And I wish this was the issue, right?
Or look at it this way. Your average sort of dude in tech who doesn't necessarily think about issues of gender and feminism and everything else, if all of a sudden they realize, oh, I'm behaving like Trump, it might actually be this really effective foil to sort of create almost a mirror for people and say, well, I don't want to be like that. So therefore, I'll change my behavior. Maybe this might be wishful thinking.
I think it's wishful. I mean, it's a little wishful thinking. I also think it depends on the generation too. Like, I think young people get it. You know, I think they see the hypocrisy. I think people who've, you know, are a little bit older and a little bit more set in their ways. And again, it was what I was saying earlier. It's like, you know, they don't really have an incentive to see power or, you know, I mean, yeah. Right? If you're set and you've been set for the last 20 years and like, why do you, you know, well, I mean, I personally think that, and luckily we're seeing data that shows that companies that have, you know, more diverse workforces and more diverse leadership perform better. I mean, the more data that comes out proving that point, I hope that will help. But it, you know, so I think the more that we see women in these visible leadership roles, I think that's really important. But I don't know. It's interesting how the political climate kind of seeps into this issue. I don't know how it's going to play out. I mean, I've been surprised every day of my life, every time I open up the newspaper, honestly, with this administration. So yeah. I can't.
Every time you check Twitter, like, oh my God.
I mean, really, it's really like you cannot make this stuff up. So I'm going to leave it at that.
So what's next for you? Do you stay on this topic? Do you write another book on it? Is there a sequel? What happens after this?
Well, I mean, I told you, I started out, I'm a storyteller. Yeah. You know, I'm definitely researching my next topic, which I will say is in the world of startups.
Okay.
But a totally different sector. Although there is some of the companies are tech enabled. We can talk about that off air. So I'm starting that research process now. Okay. And just doing a lot of speaking. The paperback edition is going to come out in May. We're, you know, getting inquiries about other potential adaptations and different, you know, offshoots of the original work. And then, of course, we're going to need to update the paperback with all of this
right.
news that's come right. out. So I'm going to be spending my fall working on that and right. sort of deciding if we're going to do an epilogue or if we're going to really do some major rewriting and kind of waiting for some direction on that. You know, with any of these companies, I mean, this topic, it just keeps changing every day. So that was probably one of the most frustrating things at the very end is there was a point when it was like pencils down and we couldn't update it anymore.
And we knew that. At some point, it's got to come out.
It was like, yeah, it was, you know, luckily we got the Susan Fowler blog post in there. We, you know, we mentioned that Travis had stepped down. We mentioned, you know, we obviously mentioned the outcome of the election, you know, so... But when we turned the manuscript in last July, I mean, we didn't know what was going to happen, and we I don't think anybody expected the outcome in Washington. So that was also, you know, we were sort of racing to kind of end the Women's March and all, you know, all this stuff, trying to figure out how to update it. So I imagine we're going to be going through a little bit of that this fall, preparing for the paperback to come out.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. Yeah. So a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, that was great. So Heather, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening.